Blessings to you in the name of Jesus Christ, and welcome to Pastors for Pastors, the podcast that supports and celebrates the pastors who lead and challenge and comfort us, especially in these difficult days. I'm your host, Ken Broman Folds.
First of all, thank you all for being with us for this second part of the podcast on forbearance and the practices that we can offer our congregations to bring unity in disagreement and to model that for the rest of the world, hopefully. With us are James Calvin Davis, professor at Middlebury College in Vermont, and the author of the book that we are using as the basis of our conversation, Forbearance, Theological Ethic for a Disagreeable Church. Leanne Scarborough is with us. She's the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Talladega, Alabama, and appreciate you both being with us today. I also wanted to say as we begin that unfortunately Susan Takis could not be with us for this second recording. She had a pastoral emergency just before we were to meet together to record and needed to take care of that. So she is not able to be with us, and our prayers are with her and with the family that she is ministering to. To kind of bridge from the first podcast, for those who were not able to listen to that one, I hope you will go back and listen to it. James, can I ask you just to kind of briefly summarize what the term forbearance means again, and then we'll talk about the several practices that we talked about last time before we pick up on the new ones today.
The term forbearance, even though it sounds rather antiquated, the term forbearance is something that I take from Ephesians and Colossians and the imperative, the apostles' imperative to bear with one another in love. And by forbearance, what I mean in our time and place is an active commitment to maintaining community in the church through practices and through character development, with a priority placed on the unity of the church that we receive in Christ. So it is an active and practiced commitment to maintaining community even through our disagreements.
And I want to add at this point, if I could, Ken, because we keep talking about the disagreeable church, and we talk about community in the church, and that's where I use the book to begin with. But I want to stress that it really, really helps people in all parts of life, that it speaks to our world, our nation, our divided nation at this point. So I don't want to just, I don't want to people to think that it just is about disagreement in the church, that this is something that we can extend to all of life, this forbearance toward one another. Although the church is the focus, these principles can be applied everywhere.
Thanks for saying that, Leanne. And that is, I mean, that's part of a conviction that is at the foundation of the book too, that it's a theological claim that what makes for good church is what makes for good human community. I love Karl Barth's description of the church as the provisional representation of all humanity, that in a sense, the church is trying to live into what God really wants for all of human beings. And so there is a natural connection between what is virtue within the context of the church and what is virtuous, what is good character and practice and community in other communities beyond the church. And that's why it makes so much sense for forbearance to be not only a practice in church, but our social witness to a public as well. What I do in the book is then, after identifying forbearance as this commitment to community through disagreement, then I ask the question, well, what are the practices? What are the virtues? What are the character traits that both form us to that active commitment, and also are the fruit that are born out of that active commitment to community? And the one I start out with is humility. I think that's the first among equals, in a sense, among the virtues, that without humility, the rest of this project just goes away. And by humility, I just mean the reminder, the Christian conviction, the confession that God is God and we are not. And part of our theological tradition is the recognition that we are finite and fallible creatures. And because we are, there is a lot that we don't know a lot that we can learn from God and others. And that recognition of the limitations of our perspective and our knowledge ought to then play into our approach to disagreement. Namely, that in moments of disagreement in the church, humility reminds us that we stand to learn something from the engagement with people who think differently than we do. It doesn't necessarily mean that we always change our minds or that our fundamental convictions are always at play, but it means that we should be prepared to learn something, even if it's learning something more about the other when we engage with somebody who thinks differently than we do.
We move on then to patience and hope. And as I asked in my email, are those two different virtues or parts of the same one that you put them both in the same chapter?
Ken, I noted that annoying question. I have no idea. I couldn't decide. To be honest, I'd been thinking about patience. I'd been thinking about patience for, it is a fruit of the Spirit, but I was thinking also in terms of kind of practical translation of the patience in some of my earlier work on civility. I'd been working on it for a very long time before a friend of mine said, where's the role of hope in all of this? You don't have hope anywhere in the virtues. It was a bit stunning to realize I'd missed that one. The more I thought of it, the more I was sensing in a real close connection between patience and hope, but I never could answer the question you posed to my satisfaction. Are these two distinct virtues or are they facets of the same virtue? There are ways in which patience seems like the more practice oriented, practical living out of hope. Hope seems like the more kind of vector governing aspect of patience. Hope is the reason why we are patient. So there does seem to be this deep connection between the two, but I could never decide which of them was more fundamental than the other. So I decided to break the symmetry of the chapters and put them in there together.
Back in the when we celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation a couple of years ago, we used a video series on the Protestant Reformation, and one of the last sections of it was a critique of Protestantism by a couple of Roman Catholic theologians. And one of the critiques that they pointed out was the lack of unity among Protestants, that every time we disagree on something, we divide and start a new denomination, a new church, new congregation. And that practice of patience and persistence out of the hope of a new day and a changed reality, I think that's something that we as Protestants are very weak on.
I agree. I think that charge sticks. Dividing and subdividing, obviously, is something Protestants do very, very well. And it's become, especially in the American context, it's just become a rule of practice that if we disagree strongly enough, that I take my ball and my bat and I go start a new church somewhere, so that you have, you know, the Presbyterians of X, Y, and Z, but not A, B, and C, until there is no real sense of the unity of the church day to day at all. And that, in part, I think, does come from a loss of focus on the idea of persisting patiently within church community instead of moving beyond church community out of a hope that the church will see a better tomorrow, and that's what animates our ability to live forbearingly in the today.
Let's talk about wisdom. And when I first saw that chapter, I thought, okay, I'm not immediately seeing the connection like I could immediately see it with, say, humility or patience or faithfulness. But then after beginning to read the chapter, it began to be one of the most important chapters, I thought. When you talk about your motorcycle and working on the motorcycle and the certain kind of wisdom that comes from manual kinds of work, as an amateur woodworker, I immediately resonated with that. And out of that, over the years, has built some wisdom about how you build things and how that transfers. And I really resonated with that. And I thought about my father-in-law, who I don't think graduated from high school, but from whom I learned most of my carpentry skills, and who had a great deal of the kind of wisdom that most of the time we call common sense.
Thanks for that, Ken, because that is, in writing it, when I first started that chapter, I wasn't quite as enthusiastic about it as some of the ones. And then by the time I was done, it was the most personally meaningful one for me, perhaps of the whole book, in part because it was an opportunity to think about the different forms that wisdom can take and the way that contributes to our living together, in part by reminding us to exercise different kinds of wisdom and reminding us that different kinds of wisdom besides the ones that we immediately recognize or exhibit exist. I'm an Appalachian hillbilly. So I am a product of Western Pennsylvania. My dad was a coal miner and my grandparents were both coal miners. And so I am bred and born to have an appreciation for that kind of wisdom. And in fact, one of the things I pride myself on as an academic and as a college administrator, which I was for a time, was my problem-solving skills. And I, as I've gotten older, have come to discover that my problem-solving skills are considerably an inheritance that I received from my dad. His ability to fix things, to build things, to solve problems is one of the most impressive that I have ever encountered. And I'd like to think he passed some of that on to me, and that I am wiser in middle age because of that. So I have a deep appreciation for that. And I think it's real wisdom. And I think it complements the more obviously kind of intellectual ways we think about wisdom, and is an important part of us understanding and respecting other people in the church. That chapter on wisdom also talks about different manifestations like discernment, which we talked about a little bit ago in our conversation. Knowing wisdom requires not only knowing what is right and good, but knowing what right and good requires in a particular moment you find yourself in, which is not always the same when the moments change. And also empathy. Empathy, I think, is an essential component of wisdom, essential to church life and essential to our civic health, and obviously is in pretty short supply these days. And then the chapter ends with thinking of wisdom as imagination. Wisdom is wisdom when it exercises imagination to imagine a world we don't yet have, or a church we don't yet have, and put ourselves to the work of making that happen. It sometimes requires us, those external things, to prompt our imagination as church. But we've been through a whole series of those in the last 10 years, a culture that's forcing us to imagine what it means to be a mainline denomination when the mainline is no longer at the center of the culture. Yeah. And out of that, in our own denomination, came all of these initiatives like new worshiping communities, for instance. I see that as an imaginative exercise in wisdom of saying, what does it mean to be church when we are not the center of the culture? Yeah. What does it mean to be church in a culture in which Black Americans demand an end to systemic oppression? What does it mean to be a church in which it is no longer an option for us to just sit on the sidelines? And what does it mean to be church in an era in which same-sex marriage is legal? And then, of course, the pandemic. What does it mean to be church when we can't be physically in the same space together? All of these, I think, are examples where the circumstances prompt us to use our imagination to ask, what does it mean to be faithful in this time and place? And that faithfulness and that prompt to be faithful in new ways requires all those other virtues that we've talked about, the kind of humility and patience to think differently and to entertain different options than what we're used to.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about empathy. It's not a new idea. The whole, how many songs and sermons have we heard that says, walk a mile in my shoes? But it's still, particularly, it seems to me, when I read Facebook posts, there is this sense that we've totally forgotten about empathy. Talk more about what you mean by that.
I do think that this is one of the most acute problems that we have in our larger society, and it has infiltrated in the church as well. And that is this inability or unwillingness to see situations from any perspective besides the one we already hold and we already think is right. And I wanted to argue by contrast that to do so is not only good in its own right, it is an exercise of wisdom. But without empathy, we can't know what we don't know. And we can't understand the impact that the issues that divide us have on people who are different than we are. And we see that, we certainly see that on social media, not only on social media, but we see that, in my opinion, social media, Facebook, et cetera, really aggravate this problem of a lack of empathy because they allow for virtual guerrilla warfare that discourages taking the time to understand what somebody else is thinking or feeling. But we've also, I think, become unused to questions that attempt out of empathy to probe us and how we got to where we are. So you told the story the last time we got together about a couple in your church who made a claim, I think, in social media. And then when other members of the church tried to ask questions that you thought were reasonable questions, what do you exactly mean by this? They clammed up and left. And I think defensiveness is one of the opposites to this kind of empathetic wisdom. We're just not willing to be questioned. We're not willing to be explored.
On the flip side of that, I think sometimes when someone makes a statement, whether it's on social media or wherever, somebody makes a statement and we want to react, you know, to that statement, that sometimes it's better to say, tell me more. Explain what you mean by that. Yes, they may get defensive and they may take their toys and walk away, but rather than reacting from my point of view, to learn more about why they feel the way they feel or why they said what they said, to me, a little bit, that's empathy. And being willing to ask those questions rather than just reacting or getting my point of view across.
And one of the wisest things that I've learned, which I still struggle, but when I'm consciously aware of it and working on it, when someone is saying something to me that I don't agree with or I don't understand, the best way for me to respond is to recap what I heard them saying. So before I respond what I think, I begin my response by saying, so what you're saying is this. Is that correct? Or did I misunderstand something? That does a couple of things. First of all, if I don't understand it, I have the opportunity of clarifying. They have the opportunity of clarifying to me. Secondly, they feel like they've been listened to. They feel like I'm treating them like legitimate human beings who have a right to an opinion, and I'm trying to understand what it is.
Ken, I think you're absolutely right about the two things you accomplish in that, and I would add one more. And this comes from my experience as a teacher. Let me back up to say that that when I was in seminary, my pastoral theology teacher, Bill Arnold, used to hammer a version of this in us in class, that when you go to a pastoral visit, what you ought to do is not enter a room prepared to tell folks how to respond to their problems, but instead to respond with, what I hear you saying is, or a form of that. And many of us in the class thought that sounded hokey and formulaic, but it was years after that that I recognized what he was trying to do was cultivate in us a practice of listening first, talking later in this kind of empathetic way. And I think this is just one example in which well-skilled pastors can model some of these virtues, because those of us who do pastoral work in that way and in the way that you just described, Ken, are exhibiting empathy. And as you suggested, it does a couple of things. It sets you up to clarify anything that you didn't understand, because you're not jumping the gun on the assumption that you understood. It also legitimizes and humanizes the other person, that as much as they think you disagree with them, you have now legitimized their perspective because you have given it voice too. But the other thing it does is it can sometimes help them understand better their own positions and the differences between theirs and yours. I see this in class because I think I have adopted a version of Bill Arnold's strategy when I'm moderating class discussions. And a student will say something, and I will often say, what I hear you saying is dot, 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 and say it back. And I've had students respond then at the end of the year in course evaluations that they've had different reactions to that. Some students have said, wow, Professor Davis had a habit of taking what seemed like a meatball comment of mine and making it sound intelligent, which was really gratifying because it's a way of helping a student better understand what they're saying by taking the raw ingredients that they have offered and helping them formulate it. And then the other way that students have voiced appreciation for that is that doing that kind of recapitulation of students' perspectives then helped form a bridge between them and students that disagreed with them, because now the students had to go through me to disagree with it, and it was just that much harder to just dismiss or diminish their colleagues' perspective. So there are so many ways in which that which empathy can not only be an attitude but an actual concrete practice that furthers conversation that I think, especially in our context, this one is worth working on deliberately.
The other thing that I think it does is it keeps us from that really bad habit of using the time while they are talking to construct our rebuttal and so that we're not really listening to them. If we get into that habit, make it a practice that the first thing we do when we're in a conversation like this is to say, this is what I hear you saying, then I can't be constructing my rebuttal. I have to be listening to what they're saying. I'm just hoping that pastors can use this as a means of maybe sermon series or an online Sunday school class or some way that this can be shared with congregations, because I really do think it's so helpful.
I have used it in our congregation on Wednesday nights. That's one of our study times. And the congregation or those who attended really, really got a lot out of it. And in fact, sometimes we challenge each other about the forbearance, about some of these virtues. In a good way, we challenge each other. We've also used In Defense of Civility, just to plug that book by James. We have done that one as well. And both of them made for good studies.
Very good. Let's talk about faithfulness and what you mean by faithfulness as something more than assent to a number of theological principles or ideas.
For some reason, when I first started working on the book, the faithfulness chapter was the hardest one for me to imagine. And I'll admit, I think faithfulness was in there at the beginning because it shows up so often in New Testament lists of virtues, and I felt compelled to include it, but I wasn't sure what I meant by it. But then the more I sat with this idea of faithfulness, it really became evocative for me, the idea of faithfulness, and it turned out, it ended up being one of my favorite chapters. What was transformative was for me is to really take seriously this idea that faith is not prescription to a set of convictions, beliefs. Faith fundamentally in the Christian tradition is trust in the good graces of God. That's what it means to have faith. That was the revelation that Martin Luther had when he was in the depths of his angst over the disconnect he felt between his performance of religious duty and his sense of looming damnation. That's certainly what John Calvin meant when he summed up the Christian life as grace and gratitude. Faith is trust. Trust in the good graces of God in our lives and in the world. And so if you start there, how does that reshape how we think about living together as church? Well, I think first of all, what it does is it decenters these litmus tests that we often have for who counts as a real Christian, because it's not that kind of prescription. And that's a very helpful thing, I think, to move those off the center of how we evaluate ourselves and one another. But then it also opens us up to asking, well, what does it mean to practice faith? And so I divide the chapter into a couple of meanings of faith and faithfulness, that faith is faith in God. And because we share this faith in God, we then are free to have faith in one another. And that trust in one another then becomes the bedrock on which we maintain community and make our way through disagreement. And the practice of faith in one another then leads to faithfulness to one another, meaning that perhaps we are a little less inclined to just take our ball and bat and go in a different direction if we end up in hard times in our church communities. And this faithfulness to one another then becomes a reflection of our faithfulness to God. That faithfulness to God is in part our commitment to honor God by honoring the unity of Christ Church. So this understanding of faith as trust opened, like a flower, kind of opened all of these different connotations of faith and faithfulness to me in a way that I found enriching.
This is the chapter that I found most challenging personally. I mean, this is the one that convicted me the way that humility convicted Ken, because and it's the one that I have the most notes on, because one of the things I remember is something about assuming the best intentions of each other, you know, assuming the best intentions in the other person, even though we may disagree with them vehemently, just to assume that they're not a bad person. We need to assume the best about them, give them the benefit of the doubt as we listen, as we try to empathize and hear, you know, hear where they're coming from. Why are they thinking the way they think? Why do they act the way they act? That faith in God enables us to have faith in each other and to be, you know, to practice forbearance. That's part of what this is about, is not writing them off simply because we disagree.
Right. And this is also another example in which I think the practice of forbearance in church is a countercultural witness, because this, like empathy, is something we just do not do in our culture. We assume the worst, and that's never been more evident in my lifetime than it is right now. We assume the worst of everyone who is on the other side of whatever dividing line we have drawn. So this is a bald characteristic of our current political culture, and this is a place, and again, where I think the church could be doing some really important witnessing this way.
And in some ways, the Christian church has done what you're talking about with ministry or mission. We have somehow at times been able to put aside our differences in how we believe in and whom we believe in, that sort of thing, and worked together for a greater good.
Yeah. Let's move on to friendship.
So friendship, the chapter on friendship is really the chapter on love. This chapter prompted me to think about love in specifically within church, in the dynamic of a community of people with a shared allegiance in Christ. And I gravitated toward this notion of friendship. And that's a hard thing to do because, as I explain in the chapter, friendship doesn't get a lot of good press in the history of Christian thought. Sometimes it's just simply underplayed. Sometimes, occasionally, friendship is seen as a kind of inferior love to what is quote-unquote real Christian love, which is Good Samaritan love, love of people regardless of who they are and their circumstances, their relationship to us, and what they do for us. And not to disparage Good Samaritan love, which is wonderful and useful and important, but I wanted to think a little bit about this idea of friendship. Love for people, for particular others, for people in whom we are very invested and who do do things for us, whether tangible things or bless us with their affection or their neighborliness or their time. How do we think about friendship as an expression of Christian love? For help on that, I went back again to the New Testament, to Jesus's insistence on talking about the disciples as his friends, him talking about self-sacrificial love as laying one's life down for one's friends. His emphasis on friendship then gets picked up by some of the epistles in the New Testament as well. So ultimately, I ended up writing about the church as a community of friends, that thinking of it that way is another step towards the virtues that would prepare us to weather disagreements in faithfulness with one another.
Well, I think we've sort of heard that criticism of some pastors. I mean, I have, maybe you have, of pastors who do so much outside the local parish that are able to spread love and spread ministry and all of the things they do, but yet they don't have much of a one-on-one connection to the people in the congregation they serve. And I think that it's easy for all of us to get that way. And like, maybe we're neglecting our families. I mean, maybe that's where we're not sharing this friendly love, this friendship or whatever. But again, this is a chapter that kind of convicts me. It makes me think back to my own life and, you know, how am I living out this virtue, or whether I'm living out this virtue the best that I can.
The family example too, Leanne, I think is a good one, because I do think that part of the problem with an exclusive focus on Good Samaritan love is it's really easy to make that some nebulous value that has really no direct impact on our life, whereas something like friendship or family love is very particular and very concrete. And an exclusive focus on that, I think when I was in graduate school, I was pastoring a church, and we had been talking a lot about missions beyond the church in our local community, and somebody slipped me a note afterwards expressing impatience with how much we were talking about missions, and it ended with the line, "Charity begins at home," which was a way of saying our focus should be closer to where we are, not in all of these faraway places. And of course, that's problematic, but it's also a good reminder. Charity includes closer to home. And I do think that we're just as apt to forget the obligations of love very close to us, especially if we are heavily invested in expressions of love and works of love well beyond the church or well beyond our family. So this chapter was really meant to just give some balance to that, especially in the context of thinking about how we maintain those local communities.
Yeah, and as you pointed out earlier, the Colossians and Ephesians letters are written to congregations who are having a hard time getting along with each other and treating one another as friends, because friendship has a basic connotation of equality, that we're all equal here. There's neither Jew nor Greek, male or female, slave nor free. We're all equal here. And I just think that that's so important to getting past the divisions that we have, to treat each other as friends with whom we love, but with whom we can still disagree and be friends.
None of these virtues of practicing forbearance require us to give up on what we think is right or good. It just changes the way that we relate to one another as we pursue what we think is right and good, so that it's a both and, not an either or. Those of us who care about justice, those of us who care about the pillars of the faith, can care about those. But the way that we navigate the differences we have with other Christians on those fronts will take on a certain character if we are true to this obligation to forbearance.
I'm hearing a lot of that with the recent discussions about racial inequality and those sorts of things. And I would hear it a lot on Facebook about if you're not preaching racial justice this week, you're not a good preacher, or if you're not doing this, then you're not, you know, you're not being faithful or whatever. And I think it's wrong to judge one another that way as well.
I agree with the point you just made, Leanne, but I am convicted by the question that comes up over and over again, whether we're talking about forbearance in church or civility in secular culture. Are there limits to it? Are there circumstances in which we are not required to forbear people in church, and in fact to extend them forbearance, given their commitment to injustices, is actually an injustice of our own? And I think that's a really, really hard question, and it's probably a harder question than I make it sound in the chapter in the book, which I would write a little bit differently than in 2020, in part because I think when I was writing in 2016 for naivete or other reasons, I was writing under the assumption that there wouldn't be folks in the church who are just baldly perpetuating racist tropes. In 2020, that's harder to assume. So figuring out, are there limits, or does forbearance just, again, require us to confront injustices in a certain way, but do not require, forbearance does not require us to retreat from our principles of what is right and good, but forbearance should still characterize the grace with which we deal with them as persons, again, in the spirit of King, loving even the segregationist. So all of this is to say, I want to acknowledge that that's a hard question that I frankly think is inadequately addressed in the book, and I'm still wrestling with.
If we make people outcasts, or if we say we're not going to have any kind of relationship with them because we disagree so vehemently with their point of view or the way that they're living their lives, then it destroys any chance for grace. It destroys any chance for a relationship that might affect change, positive change in others. You know, if we just say, I'm not going to have a relationship with you, then we have no influence, you know, no positive kind of influence on their lives. And they can influence ours. We don't have the richness of their life that that may be there in spite of, say, their racist views, or in spite of something else that we find abhorrent. They're still God's children. There's a line in the book that says something about we must persist in loving them. We must persist in loving them. And I think about that a lot when I just want to write somebody off, that I have to persist in loving them because God is doing work that I'm not aware of and that I can't understand.
This is one place out of a thousand that I'm deeply influenced by Martin Luther King Jr. I think there are theological reasons for us not to give up on people. And King gives voice to that when he insists over and over and over again that we must honor and love the imago Dei in even our most ardent enemy. There is something, I can't claim to do that in a consistent way, but there is something compelling, something I find compelling in that imperative, in that push to see the imago Dei, even in the person I think is so fundamentally and dangerously wrong on, say, an issue of race. Not to mention the practical point that you make, Leanne, too, that if part of the point of forbearance is to do social witness, to witness to the kingdom we hope will emerge, it's hard to do that if you have canceled someone and cut off all ties with them.
Fred Craddock tells the story of an old Jewish parable of the Exodus when the people of Israel are escaping Egypt, and the waters of the sea open, and all of the Israelites make it through. Water comes down and drowns all the Egyptian armies, and the story is that all of the angels in heaven are cheering that God has saved the Israelites, and they look over at God, and God is crying. And one of the angels says, why are you crying? You've just saved your children. And God answers, the Egyptians are my children too.
I hadn't heard that story. That's great.
And I think that says it all when it comes to this. Our tendency to see those who disagree with us as the Egyptians, forget that the Egyptians are God's children too. Six practices straight from Scripture that can help us bear with one another in these disagreeable days. Humility, patience, hope, wisdom, faithfulness, and friendship. I encourage you to get James's book, Forbearance, A Theological Ethic for a Disagreeable Church. It's published by Eerdmans and is available on Amazon. I'm sure you'll find it helpful as the basis of a sermon or sermon series, or as an online small group study, as will James's earlier book, In Defense of Civility, How Religion Can Unite America on Seven Moral Issues That Divide Us. I also encourage you to share this program with your friends, your pastors, and with your friends who are pastors. And if this podcast has offered something positive to you, would you do something positive for us? Subscribe and give us a positive rating. That'll make it easier for other pastors to find us when they're searching for a podcast like this. If you'd like to get in touch with me, send me an email at pastors2020@gmail.com. Thanks again for joining us. Until next time, I'm Ken Broman, folks, and this is Pastors for Pastors.